from floodwaters. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, April 3rd at the Krannert Center. This concert version of the opera, directed by Nicholas DiVirgilio, features new and returning vocalists from around the world.
Central Time. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert. The producer of the program is Harriet Williamson. The technical director is Jason Croft. Today's guest is Michael Davis. He's a journalist and Nieman Fellow, having earned a master's in journalism from Northwestern University. He's written for 9 newspapers and magazines in 7 states, including the Chicago Sun-Times, Baltimore Sun, and Evening Sun. He's held several positions in his journalism career, including sports editor, columnist, feature writer, and senior editor. He's also a former writer for TV Guide. His first book, and quite an undertaking from my perspective, is Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Hello, Mr. Davis.
Jeff, Mr. Davis is my dad. Please call me Michael.
All right. Well, okay. Michael, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us today. I opened up with the song Sing because I felt like it kind of bridged the gap between children and adults. It was, of course, written by Joe Raposo for Sesame Street.
Yes.
And then it became a top 10 hit for the Carpenters.
So
I wanted to start out something that sort of everybody was familiar with.
Yeah, that song has been covered by lots of people, including Barbara Streisand. And I don't know of any punk bands that covered it, but, you know, a lot of pop singers did through the years.
Well, Michael, let's first describe what inspired you to write this book. How were you approached by someone, or, you know, how did the idea come up?
The idea came after I was assigned to write a piece for Sesame Street's 35th anniversary, and I realized in doing the reporting for the book that no one had ever written the history of the show, to my amazement, because, you know, it had been around a very long time, and I would have thought there would have been many books written about it. But there was a scholarly book written in the early 70s and a kind of a scrapbook, coffee table book done, but that was it. And so I saw the opportunity, and the subject is just perfect for me because I was a former preschool teacher back in the 70s, and I loved writing about children's television, and that was part of my responsibility at TV Guide in this past decade. So it all made sense for me.
And the whole concept of Sesame Street began with a dinner conversation. Can you talk about one night in Manhattan in 1966, conversation between two couples, the Coonies and the Morissettes?
Yes, a dinner party with the people who were involved in television and also in the worlds of philanthropy and psychology. Lloyd Morissette was by training a psychologist, an experimental psychologist, actually, with a PhD from Yale. And he was working at the Carnegie Corporation at that time, studying new strategies to help preschool children learn more. And Jeff, I'm sure you and a number of your listeners will recall that at that time, there was an explosion of activity on campuses around the country, people trying to figure out how much preschoolers could learn and how well they could learn. And in fact, I believe on your campus there at the University of Illinois, Carl Breiter was one of those researchers. And so the dinner conversation turned to television, and Lloyd Morris had told a story about his then 3-year-old daughter, Sarah, who arose one Sunday morning, and he found her in front of the television set sitting cross-legged watching the test pattern for 30 minutes, of all things. She was so hooked on television that she'd sit there and watch nothing for 30 minutes in the hopes that the cartoons would come on. And he wondered aloud, what is it about television that would, you know, drag a child out of bed at that hour in the morning? And just sort of asked out loud, could television do more than merely entertain children? Could it teach? And Joan Ganz Cooney, who was the hostess of that party, said, I don't know, but I would sure like to find out. And that question was the impetus to create Sesame Street.
Let's go back a few years earlier and talk about the role for TV of kids that age. You review a lot of things about programs like Howdy Doody, Ding Dong School, I believe was one of them.
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess the whole concept of looking at the test pattern was those shows followed it in terms of using a lot of commercials, using their characters in the commercials, and they sold the products.
Oh, yeah. With some exceptions, and some very notable exceptions, including Captain Kangaroo and Ding Dong School, television was a great thief of time back in the late 1950s and early 60s. There were a lot of locally produced cartoon caravans with cowboys or circuses or, just little shows that were created to generate some revenue for the local station. And, they spun out old cartoons and Three Stooges episodes. So, television was still in its infancy, though. As I was working on the manuscript, I realized that, it really was only about 20 years old at that time. And along comes this show, Sesame Street, that debuted in 1969, and it completely rethought what television could provide to children. On the theory that if you could make education entertaining, you could assist children who maybe weren't getting a lot of sort of educational nourishment at home. Sesame Street was created to help indigent children in the ghettos and in the pockets of rural America where poor children lived. Of course, we know that over time that it certainly reached its target audience, but it reached an audience well beyond that. All the concentric circles moving out from the underprivileged to the very privileged, all children benefited from Sesame Street.
We'll welcome your calls for Michael Davis. We're talking about his book, Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Perhaps you have a favorite moment watching it growing up or as a parent, something that really came across to your child or children. 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area, outlying 800-222-9455. We'd welcome your calls. About the first 100 pages or so of your book, I have to admit I had to keep flipping back. There were so many names involved in the extensive research and how Cooney had assembled this team. They had to be taking somewhat of a calculated risk, too, considering all the people that were involved in the money they started pouring into this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As I was writing the book, the movie The Magnificent Seven came to mind often, because Joan Cooney, who had an undergraduate degree in education, but really not a lot of training in either children's television or in child development or any other related field, had this responsibility to go out and try to find the A team of researchers, of producers in television, of directors, of writers, and miraculously, they were able to harvest some $8 million in seed money to get the show started. $8 million in 1968-69, that was a lot of bucks. And, you know, from that, they were able to really craft the show unlike any other project in television I can think of. I mean, most times you have only a matter of a few months, but Sesame Street had 18 months of development. And because of that, Joan, as co-founder of Children's Television Workshop, was able to really pinpoint and look for the very best of the best. And so what occurred, Jeff, was a kind of a confluence of genius on the Upper West Side of New York, a collision of great minds, great talents, at just this perfect moment in cultural history to create this show.
And we didn't have really public broadcasting yet. We were just this was, you know, the concept of some of these educational programs, even for adults, were kind of in their infancy.
That is so true. I mean, Sesame Street came about around the same time that public television did. And, of course, many of your listeners will remember that Sesame Street helped give PBS its identity. I mean, so many people found the new network as a result of looking for Sesame Street for their children or their grandchildren.
Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act. How much credit can we give to him?
Plenty. Plenty. He really believed in the concept. He wanted there to be an alternative to the commercial networks, and he put his considerable weight behind it. And it wasn't long thereafter when Richard Nixon came in that he had a very different view of what, or whether the taxpayers' money should go for producing television content, and you know, very much wanted to see the experiment go away.
Well, going back on early children's television, one of the episodes that occurred regarding Captain Kangaroo may have helped put this program together, because you had some people that worked on other programs, and there was one particularly ugly night involving Bob Keeshner, Captain Kangaroo, and his staff when they were out for dinner.
Yes, there was. Bob Keeshner, you know, was a magnificent performer and creator with Captain Kangaroo. And I try to make the point in the book that, you know, Sesame Street certainly was not the first television show that attempted to teach preschoolers. Captain Kangaroo did so famously and effectively. It taught children many good things. But Bob Keeshan, the manager and sort of curator of the show, was a very difficult boss, very demanding, had a short temper, and it was very difficult to work for him. And two characters, if I may use that term, in the book, John Stone, who was one of the founding producers of Sesame Street, and his buddy and co-writer Tom Whedon, were lubricating their tonsils with Bob Keeshan at a steakhouse in New York, and everybody drank a little bit too much. And it was at a time when Keeshan was asking them to not only write for the Captain Kangaroo show, but for another show at the same rate of pay, and they just basically got up and quit on the spot. As it turned out, really, Captain Kangaroo was responsible for all of the members of the first creative team of Sesame Street. The three founding producers all had a term of service working on that show, and they all gave a lot of credit to Bob Keeshan for giving them a vision of what television could be for children, what nourishing good television could be.
We got a couple of callers lined up, and I'd like to go to line one in Urbana. You're on the air with Michael Davis.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for doing this program and for writing the book. I was kind of wondering what kind of methods they used to test whether it was being effective or not, whether Sesame Street was actually teaching people. And if we can learn from that now in the educational system, instead of, you know, using the written test, if there is actually something that actually does evaluate whether people actually learn or not. And I'll hang up.
Great question. Thank you for asking it. You know, there's a mound of research that has been accumulated through the years by Children's Television Workshop, which is now called Sesame Workshop, and a very good book, if anyone is interested in checking it out, it's called G is for Growing, and that is a book that sort of harvests all the research together in a very readable way and explains what has been learned over the 40 years about what children can and do learn from television. But the short answer is that the creators of Sesame Street were very smart in realizing that they needed to hire on an independent research team to evaluate the show, that it couldn't be done in-house. And so they went to Princeton, New Jersey, to ETS, and had the same people who gave us the college boards come in and devise the system for evaluating the effectiveness of the show. It was a really smart thing to do, and something no other television at that time, or hardly since, has ever done.
We have a caller on line two from Urbana. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is, what is the international influence that Sesame Street has had?
I don't think you can calculate it. Sesame Street is co-productions of it or original productions of it are seen in 140 different countries around the globe on every continent but Antarctica. You know, in recent years, co-productions have popped up in hotspots like Northern Ireland and Bosnia and India, and you know, it's just an amazing phenomenon, the globalization of the show. And as I say, I don't think you can calculate how much good it has done in the world and what a great ambassadorial role Sesame Street has played for the United States.
We're talking with Michael Davis about his book, Street Gang, The Complete complete History of Sesame Street. All these researchers were doing so much, putting so much time in, Joan Cooney and her team. Jim Henson became involved kind of late in the game.
He did. He came in the latter part of the summer of 1969 after the original test episodes for the show were shot, and the scenes that were done on the street itself bombed with an audience of kids, little test groups of preschool children. The puppets were not on the street at the time, and the kids found the adults tedious and boring. So they knew they needed to do something, and quickly, to turn that around. And John Stone, who had worked with Jim Henson on a project that was filmed in Canada called Hey Cinderella, said, you know, I have the perfect person to bring in. And the founding producer said, well, if we're going to have a puppeteer, we're going to have Jim Henson. If we can't have Jim Henson, we won't have a puppeteer. And Jim, long before Sesame Street, had sketches in his notebook of a walk-around puppet that was, you know, a big ungainly bird. And, you know, he modified that character to become, as we know, you know, a Big Bird, who for the first season of Sesame Street was really nothing like what he became later. He really was a kind of a country bumpkin character who would bang his head on door frames and had a kind of a goofy voice. But because of the combined brilliance of the puppeteer Carol Spinney and a great writing staff, they found a much better use for that character in turning him into a surrogate child of about a six-year-old, and that's what Big Bird has been ever since.
We have another caller on line one in Urbana. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. I know one of the things that I really appreciate about Sesame Street is it's one of the few children's programs that I feel like I really want to watch with my children. I feel like they make efforts by putting on celebrities and, you know, that parents are aware of, interested in, and also by keeping characters there that we grew up with. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, that's all done by design. Right from the very start, the producers wanted to create a show that would be palatable to parents and grandparents. But beyond that, they made a show that was sort of a confection that parents and grandparents looked forward to by virtue of bringing in those great stars of music and film and theater and sports. And, you know, the list of guest performers on Sesame Street really is the greatest alumni association in the history of show business. I mean, just about everybody appeared on Sesame Street, from Ray Charles to Yo-Yo Ma to Itzhak Perlman to R.E.M., and, you know, it just goes on and on and on and on. And the supposition was in the early years that if you could hook the parents and the grandparents and the caregivers, the babysitters and the older siblings, into watching, the children likely would learn more. And what happened was that notion was tested over the years, and it has been found to be absolutely true that children watching Sesame Street learn considerably more when there's an adult around.
Thank you.
The show finally premiered and came to a great deal of praise, but you also had some conservative replies to the show. One critic I remember from the book mentioned that it was taking away this responsibility of the adult to teach reading to parents, and Mississippi Public Broadcasting was upset about the integration of the cast.
Yeah, you don't have to look very far to find criticism of Sesame Street at any era in the show's history. Certainly, it was there from the start. A lot of teachers were, you know, quite upset, the kindergarten teachers especially, that the children were arriving now at the school door far more prepared for kindergarten, knowing things that were part of the curriculum, and they had to revise their lesson plans for years thereafter to sort of adapt to these changes that were not expected, you know, certainly not from television. You know, there have always been people who wanted to take a whack at Sesame Street and, you know, criticize it for its pace or for its style, for you know, the quick cuts in the early years, because Sesame Street was patterned after Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, which was, I'm sure some of your listeners will remember fondly, kind of a very funny, rapid-fire, joke-a-minute television show, and that's the way that Sesame Street was envisioned at the start. There would be lots and lots and lots of short segments and lots of repetition. But to the great credit of the people at CTW, now Sesame Workshop, they invited criticism. They responded to it sort of even-handedly and with a cool head, and always sort of took in what people were having to say about the show, and in some ways responded to the criticism by changing the show when the feminists of this world were raising their fists and saying, hey, wait a minute, why did you create this show with a female character in Susan who was just staying home and making milk and cookies? Why can't she have a job? When that criticism arose, Susan suddenly the next season had a job as a nurse. When the Hispanic community said, where are we in this show? We're unrepresented. The show was modified to bring in Luis and Maria and lots of Hispanic characters that followed. So I give a lot of credit to them for being big enough to absorb the criticism and learn from it.
We've got a caller on line one in Champaign. Go ahead on there with Michael Davis.
Yeah, hi. Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I had read, I don't know, maybe quite a few years ago, and then just checking, you know, the validity of what I read. In terms of testing for attention span, that I understand they would start a segment and with a group of children, and then they'd also start another one at the same, a little bit later, to see that, in other words, when they were disinterested in the one they were watching, they'd actually go and watch the other one. Was that true or not?
Yeah, you're very close. They would show video on one screen, and then on a screen not far away, they would show slides of animals or children at play, and they would measure, you know, how long a child's attention would stay focused on the video and how easily the child would be distracted by the other images, and from that they created a little study about, you know, what to determine what segments were working and what segments were not. They called that evil machine the distractor.
Okay, great.
So you were right on it. That you have a very good memory.
We're welcoming your calls for Michael Davis. We're discussing his book on the history of Sesame Street. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You mentioned a little bit about the human cast and all the racial harmony that was involved in the show and a rarity at that time. Let's talk about how some of the puppeteers came along. Henson and Frank Oz were the two that really they knew each other prior to the show, and then some of the others came along just through chance meetings and such.
Yeah, they did. Jim Henson and Frank Oz were more than just colleagues. I mean, they really were like brothers. And when you see Bert and Ernie on the screen, you're really seeing kind of a projection of their friendship in so many ways, because Jim was mischievous and playful like Ernie, and Frank is a little square, actually. He's very serious-minded, and while he doesn't collect paper clips and have pigeons on the roof, he is a much straighter guy than Jim Henson ever was. So, together they created one of the great comedy teams of all time. And I'd have to say, too, that Jim had an incredible gift for hiring well. Not only was a brilliant puppeteer and a pretty darn good business person, he hired brilliantly. He just had a great, great eye for puppeteering talent. And, just found these people around the United States who came in to be part of the ensemble. And, each had his or her own gift. And he found ways to create characters that were, expressions of that gift for each of the people he hired.
And there's some interesting stories behind we briefly talked about the human cast of the show. I mean, a lot of people were asked to audition, and they said, oh, I don't want to do another kids show.
Almost all of them, rolled their eyes and, thought, oh, goodness gracious, I don't want any part of some icky children's show. Loretta Long, who was Susan, she was one of them. Bob McGrath, an Illinoisan, also was totally uninterested in joining the cast at first because he just thought it would be a waste of his time. And Bob, wonderful singer, he was part of Mitch Miller's Sing Along with Mitch on NBC and had this sort of second career in Japan where he was like the Andy Williams of that country. He was a big recording star. And, here in the United States, less so, but he was really reluctant to join Sesame Street until he saw some film that was created. He saw some of the animated segments. He saw some of the live-action little movies and was totally hooked and wanted to be part of it and has been part of it ever since.
And the show had its share of, obviously first and foremost, Jim Henson dying at 52, but a lot of tragic cases involving people just that succumbed to disease. And the one that stands out for me near the end of the book is that of Northern Calloway, who was David. He battled a lot of personal demons.
He did. And, for me, that's the heart of the book, that Street Gang is about a group of men whose names eerily began with the letter J, and all of these men were brilliant at their time and gave the show so much during their time on this earth, but all died young. Jim Henson is just one of them that you know, but John Stone, the legendary executive producer of the show, and Joe Raposo, whose music he used at the top of the show, and Jeff Moss, who was a brilliant writer and lyricist and composer, all of these guys died young. And, I take you into their lives and explain, I hope I explain well, what it is that they gave to the show and how Sesame Street, more than any television show I can think of, was just such an ensemble project right from the start, and it still is. It really is not about just one person. And one of the things I wanted to kind of make clear in the book is that, it just wasn't Joan Cooney and Jim Henson, both of whom got the lion's share of the credit through the years. It was so many more people than that. And interestingly, Joan Cooney was behind the project right from the beginning, because I said that to her. I want to straighten this out, that people think it's just you, and it's not just you. And she wanted to straighten that out as well. She realized that she became the face and the voice of Sesame Street and received all of these honorary degrees at different universities. But along the way, she tried to explain to people that it wasn't just her. And so she's very happy with this book, and I'm happy that she's happy.
Welcoming your calls, questions for Michael Davis at 333-9455 or outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit about more about the role of song in the show. We've got if I can ask our technical director to cue up something else. We played Sing, that was more of a universal song, being that it was such a hit for adults and enjoyed by kids. I'm going to cue up Ernie here and play a few seconds of Rubber Ducky.
Well, here I am in my tubby again, and my tubby's all filled with water and nice fluffy suds. And I've got my soap and washcloth to wash myself. And I've got my nifty scrub brush to help me scrub my back. And I've got a big fluffy towel to dry myself when I'm done. But there's one other thing that makes tubby time the very best time of the whole day. And do you know what that is? It's a very special friend of mine, my very favorite little pal. Oh, Rubber Ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun. Rubber Ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Bo, bo, bo-dee-o. Rubber Ducky, joy of joys. When I squeeze you, you make noise. Rubber Ducky, you're my very best friend, it's true.
That was Ernie, of course, with Rubber Ducky, a song composed by Jeff Moss, I believe.
Yes.
And it was also a Billboard hit.
It was indeed. Rocketed up the charts to the chagrin of Joe Raposo, who wrote so many songs for Sesame Street but didn't even come close to having a Billboard hit. Here's Jeff Moss and one of his early attempts at creating a song for the show, and that song made him a lot of money. because it just has been used so much through the years. And you can't help but smile when you hear Rubber Ducky in that Bayodido-do, Rudy Valley kind of style, you know? It's so clever, and it's so catchy, and it's so Ernie. It's such an expression of who that character is.
I guess I want to change the mood here a little bit to talk about a particular episode, if anybody else has a moment that stands out for them, and welcome your calls and questions for Michael Davis. One episode you chronicled near the end of the book, and I'm glad you did, was the death of Will Lee, who played Mr. Hooper, and brought about an opportunity to on the show to explain death to Big Bird and teach a lesson to children.
Well, I mean, what other children's television show can you name that would try to take on the issue of death and try to explain it to an audience of 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. I mean, goodness gracious, death is a subject that we as adults struggle with, and so much credit goes to the producers of the show, the guardians of the show, who at the time of Will Lee's death decided to find a way to honor him and to try to explain to children why he wasn't there anymore. Most television shows, episodic shows, would either write the character out or recast the character. You know, here was a group of people who wanted to use the opportunity as a teachable moment. And the writing staff undertook what is referred to at Sesame Workshop as a curriculum bath. They were immersed into the world of research about children and death. They brought in people from the worlds of child development and psychology, psychiatry. They brought in people from the clergy. They brought in all kinds of great minds to offer ideas on how this might be explained and to point out the bumps in the road that could be difficult, for anybody trying to write about it. And out came this gorgeous script from the typewriter of Norman Stiles, a piece of television that I think ranks with the very best of children's television of all time, a very beautiful, moving, poignant, and right to the heart of things script that I think is just a treasure.
They had their series, you know, their share of failed experiments too. They introduced at one point an African American Muppet character, mm-hmm. Roosevelt Franklin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the African American community was really split on the subject of Roosevelt Franklin. There were people who absolutely loved him because he was unabashedly urban and funny and hip and used street lingo, and there's a part of the community that felt that all that Roosevelt Franklin was doing was just underscoring stereotypes of the community, and that this was not a good thing, and that the character should not be using street language. And so it caused Joan Ganz Cooney a major headache. Although she loved the character and would have preferred that he stay on the show, she did bend to the will of people who were saying, look, you would not want to perpetuate a stereotype. And so the character was written out of the show. But because we live in a great century, anybody could go to YouTube and type in Roosevelt Franklin and see any number of skits involving the character. And he is as funny as fresh and as fresh today as he ever was.
Let's talk about the Henson. Often, he never wanted to be known as a children's entertainer. He even called Joan Ganz Cooney one day and said, "You ruined my life," making reference to the way that he'd been, believed to him, pigeonholed into this role as a children's entertainer.
Yes, he did not want to be thought of as a children's entertainer. He wanted to be thought of as a family entertainer, and there is a distinction there, of course, and there's no greater example of what a family entertainer could do than The Muppet Show, which, of course, came to television after Sesame Street and entertained people of all ages and all cultures and was and still is the greatest success in the history of syndicated television. Jim had a great fear that the adult audience that was so important to him would abandon him. And he got his start in creating commercials for the adult world. I mean, again, many of your listeners may remember some of his great commercials for Larcherain Coffee in the East and Wilkins Coffee for Purina, for IBM, for so many, for La Choy Chinese food, the wonderful La Choy Dragon, Jim's first major walk-around character. So it was very important to Jim to be satirical. And, you know, it takes more than a small amount of sophistication to appreciate satire. And he was a satirical guy, and he wanted to have that adult audience. So as it turned out, of course he did. But there was a point in the history of Sesame Street, because it was so big and so ubiquitous, he was really concerned that it was going to work against him.
And you mentioned The Muppet Show briefly on here. This was a show that was pitched around and ended up being produced by British broadcasters.
Yeah. Famously, all three of the major television networks in the United States at the time, ABC, CBS, and NBC, passed on The Muppet Show, just as NBC and CBS passed on Sesame Street. And I call that in the book a billion-dollar blunder. It's at least a billion-dollar blunder, if not more so.
You know, I have to admit, this is a really personal thing for me. My mom actually got me this book, and I decided right away I should do this program. I pretty much learned to read by somewhat watching Sesame Street, but more so The Electric Company.
Oh, yeah.
And they decided, you know, after a few years of Sesame Street, they had to do a second show from the CTW.
And, you know, had there never been a Sesame Street and only been an Electric Company, we'd be talking about it as the greatest children's show of all time. It, too, was wonderfully inventive, effective, funny, memorable. It's just one of the – I don't think, again, we can calculate how much good that show did, how many readers were created from those episodes in the 1970s. A wonderful show.
I haven't watched the show in years. I was just mentioning to a colleague here at work a few days ago, that he was telling me, you know, now it includes digital animation, new Muppets. Late in the book, you introduce Zoe, and of course we have characters like Elmo, which I'm more familiar with the toys than the character on the show.
Yes.
So how has it evolved over the years? Are they?
It certainly always has had a reputation well-earned for seeking out great new filmmakers, animators, you know, always trying to look entirely new and fresh. And I think that Sesame Street still has that earned reputation. The most recent Sesame Street had some really eye-popping animations that were so funny and so much in the spirit of what the show has represented all these years. The core characters are still there. They use Cookie Monster well. He introduces the letter of the day. They use the count to introduce the number of the day. But they surround some of the core characters with newer ones. Elmo has been around for quite a while, but Abby Cadabby was added in the last couple of years, and she's a delightful character. They write well for her, and the performer who does Abby Cadabby is brilliant. And I think Jim Henson would be very happy with the state of the show and very happy with some of these new characters that have come around, because they are very much in the spirit of his original creations, fun and funny.
I hate to bring up sadness attached to the show again, but your prologue was devastating, talking about, you know, it brought me to tears reading about the funeral of Jim Henson. But it almost appeared as if, as you mentioned, like he knew he was going to die. Years before this sudden death, he had explained how he wanted the funeral service to take place, and it's like he was too much of a workaholic to take care of himself.
Yeah, Jeff, you know, I wish he was around to ask that question, because it certainly did seem like Jim had a premonition or at least some thought that he might not be around to enjoy his grandchildren, because he took so many steps to prepare for the day when he might pass. And, you know, his memorial service at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York was entirely sort of scripted and produced by Jim Henson in notes that he gave to the family. And, you know, we got to remember he was only 53 when he passed. Most men of that age don't spend that much time considering, you know, all of the details of a memorial service, but he did. And he was fascinated by the afterlife, fascinated, and consulted psychics and mediums and, you know, had no fear of the afterlife. And so definitely there was something going on there with Jim that many of his friends and associates believe was some kind of, not a wish to die, certainly didn't want to die, but at least some kind of premonition or thought that he his time on Earth might be not as long as people wished it would have been. Because, you know, Jim Henson's death, it's a little bit like, for some people, like, where were you when John F. Kennedy was assassinated? People seem to remember quite clearly the circumstances under which they heard about Jim Henson's passing.
One thing that also a sad note attached to the show that occurred after the book had come out, the program hasn't been spared in the wake of the current economy. 67 employees, or 20% of the staff, was let go.
That's a lot of people, and, you know, a lot of people were stunned that their jobs were coming to an end. I know the people who were involved in making those decisions, and I can tell you there was no joy there. And they wouldn't have done it unless they really had to do it. It was a tough, tough decision. The only thing I can say about looking at the big picture of Sesame Workshop is that at previous times when they've had to make severe cutbacks in staff, when the economy has brightened, they did a very good job of reloading and trying to hire back people or hiring new people who could assume the old roles and reimagine them. So as a nonprofit, which they are, they've been resilient and resourceful, having to make the tough decisions through the years, but finding a way afterward to kind of get back up on their feet. And, you know, certainly I hope that for them, and I hope for the people who are out of work, that they find work quickly and take what they've learned at Sesame Workshop and use it toward a better, you know, a greater goal in their careers. When you look at the gatekeepers of children's television in the United States, at Nickelodeon and Discovery Kids and Disney Channel, you'll find that almost everyone served a term of service at Sesame Workshop. It has become like the great graduate school of preschool children's television. So all of these folks who had to part ways with the company leave with a kind of a pedigree, if you will. And, you know, everybody's getting hit. And that's the sad fact of 2009. It's very, very difficult out there.
We've got to wrap this up. Any parting thoughts? Your daughter's a second grade teacher. Any comments she had to make after the book came out?
She's very proud of her dad. And the children she teaches are sort of excited by the idea that somebody can actually make a living writing. You know, they are just learning how to write, and my daughter explains to them, if you do it well enough and long enough, maybe you too can write a book. So that's a delightful thing for me to think about. And some of those children have visited my website, streetgangbook.com, and sent me little notes on their reactions to it. So it's been a delight, actually.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. This hour just flew by.
Thank you, Jeff.
Michael Davis is the author of Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. The book is published by Viking. Now we should turn to Todd Gleason. He's got closing numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Let's take a look at those numbers in a moment as they came in from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange on this Monday afternoon. Futures like this in the wheat pit nearby May contract at 5.12 1/2 cents, a settlement price. Up 5.25 today, the high price at 5.16, the low at 5.01, and a settlement price for the May wheat at 5.12 1/2, 5.25 higher on the afternoon. July futures, 5.27 1/2, the high, the low at $5.13 3/4. Settlement price at $5.25 1/4, up 5.25, and September wheat at 5.52 1/4 top, a bottom at 5.40, settle at 5.55, or rather 5.51 1/2, up 5.75. December wheat, 5 cents the gain, 5.77 1/4 the high, the low at $5.63. Settlement price just at 5.74 1/2, up 5. And March contract for 2010, $5.91 the high, the low at 5.79 3/4. Settlement price at $5.90 1/2. The March hard red winter, rather soft red winter wheat in Chicago settled 5.5 cents higher on the afternoon. Now from Kansas City, where they do trade the hard red winter wheat, lead option May, a 5.65 top, bottom at 46.5. Settlement price at 5.54 1/2, up 4.5 cents. July, the harvest month, 5.69 1/2 in Kansas City for the high. The low at $5.55, settlement price for the hard red winter wheat. July contract in Kansas City, $5.65 1/2, up a nickel on the afternoon. May corn futures settled 0.75 cents lower. 3.89 1/2 was the top of the trade for the day. The low at 76 3/4 with a settlement price at $3.86 1/4 a bushel. Down 0.75 cents. July futures, 3.99 3/4 the high. The low at 3.87 1/2, settlement price at $3.96 3/4, down 0.75 cents. In September, 4.09 1/2, or rather 4.09 1/4 the high, the low at 3.99 1/2, settlement price for the SEP corn at 4.06, a penny lower. December was down one as well. $4.22 the high, the low at 4.09 1/2 in the lead option, or rather the harvest month, settled at 4.18 1/4. For the new crop, December corn down a penny on the day. March futures, 4.35 4.34 1/2 the high, the low at 4.22, settlement price at 4.29 3/4, 2 1/4 lower. And the May 2010 contract, 4.38 1/2 the high, the low at 31 1/2, settlement price at 4.38, a penny and a half lower. May oat futures, $1.97 1/4 the top, the bottom at 1.93, settlement price at $1.93, 2.5 cents lower. In July contract, down 2 cents, 2.05 1/2 the high, the low at 2.02. Settled at 202 on that low, down 2 for the July oat futures. May contract in the soybean pit, a 12.5 cent loss. $9.24 the high for the lead option, the low at $8.97. Settlement price for the soybeans, 904.5, down 12.5 for the May contract. July, 922.5 the high, the low at 895.5. Settled at $9.02, down 13.25. And the August, 892.75 the high, the low at 882. Settlement price, $8.86, down 14.75. September soybeans, $8.77, the high, the low at $8.50. Settled 8.54 1/2, down 17.25. November beans, $8.67 3/4, the top, the bottom at 36 3/4. A settlement price at 8.42, down 18 3/4. January soybeans, 19 cents lower, $8.75 1/2, the high, the low at 47 1/4. Settlement price at $8.52.5, down 19 cents on the day. May bean meal futures, $285.50. The top, the bottom at $277.70. Settlement price at $281.50, down 230. And July at $281.20 high, the low at $273.90. Settlement price at $277.20, down $2.70. May bean oil, $32.82 the high, the low at $31.76. Settlement price at $32.04, 38 cents lower on the day. In July, oil $33.10 the high, the low at $32.05. July bean oil settled $32.34, down 38 cents. Speaking of oil, let's check in on the outside markets. Crude oil futures at this hour are down $3.32 at $49.06 a barrel in the nearby May. June at $51.25, down $2.77. April ethanol at $1.56.7 is settled, down 2 cents on the afternoon. Natural gas at $3.74.9, up 1 2 cents. And the RBOB gasoline trading at $1.38.5, 10 2/10 cents lower at this hour. Heat and oil futures still trading for the day, 9 cents lower at $1.34.3. And the propane, 68.5 cents. Trading down 3 cents at this hour. Gold futures down $7.70. A settlement price there at $915.50. And the Dow currently down 319 points at 7456. Livestock numbers are settled in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange. Live cattle futures, April contract today, down $1.50, 83.80 the high. Low at 82.80. A settlement price at 82.82.5, down 150. June live cattle, $81.05 the high, the low at $80. Settlement price at $80.07.5, down $1.50. And the August, $82.25 the high, the low at $80.95. Settled at $81.02.5 for 100 pounds, down $1.50 for the August live cattle. October contract, $86 the high, the low at $84.75. Settlement price at $84.82.5, down $1.35 for the day. Feeder cattle, nearby April contract, $93 the high, the low at $92.15. Settlement price, 92.5 cents lower at $92.20. May contract, $94 the high, the low at $92.85. Settlement price at $93.05, down $1.25. In the August feeders, $96.55 the high, the low at $95.60. Settlement price there at $95.85, down $1.05. April lean hog, $60.90 the high, the low at $60.25. Settled at $60.55, 7.5 higher, but the rest of those contracts were lower for the day, down 55 cents in the May contract for the lean hogs, $70.80 the high, the low at $70.40. Settlement price at $70.65, 100 weight, down 55 cents. June futures, $71.20 the high, the low at $70.57.5. Settlement price at $70.97.5, 42.5 lower. In July lean hog futures, $72.05 the high, the low at $71.60. Settlement price, $71.60, down 80 cents. And the frozen pork bellies, $2.15 lower to settle at $83.75. In the May, the July down $1 at $80.55. When we return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time this afternoon during the closing market report, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He is the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. Later in that program, we'll hear all about the connection between crude oil, ethanol, and the price of corn. Darrell Good will explain how that moved up and down together during the 07 and 08 calendar years and why it unhooked for a bit and how it might hook back up in the 09 calendar year. That all comes up during this afternoon's edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
If you're interested in learning more about the agricultural programming here at WILL, you can always visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find the pre-opening and opening market reports, the closing market reports, and the midday update with Sue Martin, all as an MP3 file that you can listen to directly right on our website, or sign up to have most of those delivered to you automatically as a podcast. It's all at willag.org. And a way to subscribe to our weekend newsletter, please visit willag.org. Here's the weather forecast, that is, for the two-state region from our own Mike Sola. He says today in Indiana should be mostly sunny. In Illinois, partly to mostly sunny. Highs will range from around 40 near Lake Michigan to 64 in the far southern part of the state of Illinois. In Illinois tonight, increasing cloudiness, a few showers, some thunderstorms arriving in the west. They'll spread to the east. In Indiana, becoming partly cloudy, lows will range from 34 in the north to 50 in the southern part of Illinois tonight. And then tomorrow in western Illinois, rain ending early, then becoming partly sunny. In eastern Illinois and in Indiana, cloudy, some showers, a widely scattered thunderstorm or two, diminishing west to east during the afternoon. Highs will range tomorrow from 50 in the northern part of Illinois to 65 in the southeastern part of Indiana. You're listening to WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM.